Harold, thank you so much for that introduction, and Becky, thank you for inviting me here. And I'd just like to say that in case people think I might have just kind of plopped into the situation with Franco, that we both go back a very, very long way. I've known Franco's work for a very long time. I participated in this exhibition. I haven't even bothered to look at what date this was. But I've been to many, many... 2001, a very first year. And I've worked very extensively on Franco and been to many of his performances. But on his birthday this year, January the 27th, at the Courtauld, we actually showed, I don't know whether it was a premiere, but we showed the extraordinary film that Franco has made, which is based on the autobiographical recollections that he's produced recently, which are of amazing sharpness and clarity and a power of recollection of his past, and also which trace him as he went back to where he was born and to the scenes of his child, his own childhood as somebody who wasn't, as it were, a refugee from his country, which he later became in some way, if you like, but a child who didn't know his father, had a childhood in an orphanage, had encountered certain concepts in very brutal ways, and who tells through this film the story of how, in the most miraculous way, basically, and I think both Franco and I believe in miracles, how through what the French would call a parcours, kind of chance encounters and encouragements, he sees certain moments and was perceptive to certain things and managed to get, partly, I understand it, for reasons of fleeing his military service, partly managed to get from Italy to London, and having, in ways we'll talk about later, experienced being down and out, being kicked around, being a rough sleeper, as in the little installation we see, managed to get his way into art school, managed, I don't mean to read the right books, but managed to understand the intellectual world, which involved figures like Freud, and managed to become an artist. And obviously that gives you, it both acknowledges your own innate creative power, but it involves what you can give back from that part. So, Franco, what I want to do is actually not, this is not like, and now over to you. What I actually want to do is go back to a certain moment, because what's special about Franco as well is not just his trajectory, how he managed to encounter things, and how he managed to understand that by being what is called an artist, he could express himself and talk about certain things and give back things. But what I personally like about Franco is that he has a very powerful and very acute aesthetic sense, which is pretty rare, even amongst a lot of contemporary artists. The best ones actually have this deep, deep sense. But what I want to go back to, Franco, without going into your origins and certain stories which will nonetheless come, is this the particular moment when you first see art. We've both actually just come back from the Venice Biennale, and what Franco is giving us here is two particular works of art. And suddenly this little boy brought up in an orphanage goes on an excursion, and I'll just read this to you from something I once read. So I'll just read this little paragraph, okay? It says, Franco's first 7 years were spent in an orphanage in Brescia in northern Italy, run by priests. He returned to his mother for the next 3 years in a small town near Novara. Again, he found himself sent away, this time to an institution run by the Red Cross, not far from Lake Mergozzo. In the summer of 1973, while staying in a Red Cross holiday camp at Marina di Massa near Carrara, famous for its marble, in Tuscany, he went on a trip to Florence. Here, for the first time, he was taken to the Uffizi and discovered the Madonnas, angels, and demons of the Florentine churches, St. Francis, St. Sebastian, the repentant Magdalene, transfigurations and torments, depictions of life, death, and martyrdom. Franco's life-changing confrontation with painting and sculpture would be intellectually consolidated only much later in England when he was in his early 20s. And what is so incredible in those pictures downstairs, those cutouts, which seem like almost a little kind of Damien Hirst or Sigmund Freud cabinet, is actually those cutouts were life-size cutouts of rough sleepers where the drapery takes us back to that first transfiguration and those experiences of folds and colours in Italian painting. And we'll move from painting, of course, to sculpture and Sleeping Beauty, but that transfigurative moment of encountering painting and art is how I'd like us to begin, Franco.
Yeah.
So over to you.
Over to me, yeah. That's very good. Yeah. Well,
because you had an ordinary life as a child with all these troubles,
yes,
and then you saw art at the Uffizi.
Yeah, but not only. Actually,
you'd seen it presumably in
yeah, but it wasn't. But it's obviously didn't. I remember going to the Uffizi that moment, but of course that moment was lost because of more immediate kind of existential life issues, problem that I had as a 13 years old or 14 years old. And then of course after 14 I was back with my parents for a year and a half. So there was a moment, I think, from like when I left the Red Cross to when I was about 23, that art was not a conscious thing for me.
But when
it
you
was
first
existential. Yeah, but I tell you the catalyst, the second, I think in retrospective, of course, the Uffizi, I remember being a child in this kind of huge kind of, you know, museum, but actually the catalyst was one day a friend of mine said to me, a friend out of somebody I met that was doing MA sculpture at St. Martin. This was 1983. And I said, come to Tate Britain. I've never been to Tate Britain. And I went around to Tate Britain one Sunday afternoon. And at the moment I was washing up in an Italian restaurant, you know, 9:30 to 3 o'clock. And the rest of the time I was kind of just, you know, being a punk, being myself, surviving. And I come into this room, which was then was closed, which was a room which had this artist called Mark Rothko. And that was the moment I decided I wanted to be an artist. Consciously, I became aware that art was the only thing that could make me want carry on to be alive, to stay around. And that was the only kind of escape from my kind of existential, you know, what I'm gonna do, you know. Maybe something that people have, but I remember away thinking I wasn't gonna make it to 25, you know, that I didn't want to live of, and that maybe it was kind of romantic, punks, which is that young, a lot of people that young, all the cool people that young, you know.
I know,
so
that's why
I wanted to die young too, but I wasn't that cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's really different. So, but I nearly died accidentally a few times. And, so after I found what I wanted to do, so, you know. But
what's so interesting is that it's an absolute example of how, even by interviewing Franco and learning about that moment, and then of course I fantasize it about it myself, and I read those folds, which I do believe still exist in those beautiful still lives, but thinking that that was the moment, you correct me, this is why it's much more interesting to work with living artists than people who died young, because you actually say, no, it wasn't that one, it was this one, and the Rothko room, as we know, is completely it's got no figuration in it at all, the Rothko room.
That was amazing.
The moment.
But Rothko,
it's the atmosphere, isn't it? And it's a very, very those works were actually going to be in a
and also how they were, restaurant. But also how they were displaying back then.
Yes.
Because they don't have the same effect that they had modern. I remember also maybe because, you know, I don't know, maybe I was shooting too much speed and I was coming down, you know, and I found myself in this space that felt like, actually recently I kind of connected to some of the Turner painting, where somehow you cannot focus. It's like there is like some kind of mist, fog, you know. And I remember it was like some scene in some films where you're kind of towards the end and you realize that somehow you realize what the story is, you know? Mm. And that, the painting wasn't about that, but I remember being there, I seen really long time, maybe it wasn't that long, but I felt the eternity, and eventually my friend came and looked for me and asked and said, oh, shall we go? But it seems like hours, I probably was there 45 minutes, an hour. Mm. And I remember it was like there was kind of Turner, Venice, when I was homeless in Venice in February, where you kind of see...
The same year?
Yes.
The same year?
No, I was homeless in Venice in 79.
But you're saying it was the coldness of being homeless in Venice. That...
Yes, yeah. But it's also the magic, you know. Because the interesting thing about when I was homeless, I didn't see myself as homeless. I saw myself as a traveler. There wasn't the kind of conscience and the kind of maybe the kind of burden.
Yeah.
Of being homeless. Mm. I was free. Mm. Yeah. I was like a vagabond. I was lost. I was running away. Don't know where from. But it was like, you know, I was like, I kind of live day to day. But I didn't see myself, it was just that, you know, I had to beg, I begged, I had to rob, I robbed, you know. But it wasn't like a burden on me. It wasn't like, oh, poor me, I'm homeless, you know, help me. It wasn't like that. Mm. And certainly, it was a way, I was traveling, and I was kind of somehow negotiating what was like to be alive in kind of in limbo, you know, because I was in limbo, you know, I didn't have
You were in limbo, but you were free.
Yes, I was in limbo, but I was free. Mm. So it's like, I think the free was to do with being ignorant about maybe with being a kind of disingenuous about my kind of moment, you know? Mm. It's not like reading George Orwell, out of, you know.
No, but then of course the whole point is you're going back to things. So it's very difficult, I think, for people who come to see that cabinet and see these very small miniature things. Most of art is, of course, miniaturized.
Yeah.
But in that, when I first saw those things, they were cut out life size.
Yes.
And Franco put them on steps in places in London, like the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral. But he's just told me he also put them in the step in front of the hotel in the Lido where they shot Death in Venice, and how close the people were in this very posh part of Venice.
Yeah.
You know, where all the posh people stay, where there's the beach.
Yeah, and the hotel says yes. The hotel gives. Yeah. I was in an exhibition contest called Open.
But you knew what it felt. You knew what it felt like to be homeless yourself.
Yeah, because also, just like 200 yards from there on the beach, when it came May, I would sleep on the beach, and the police would come around, and private security back then, like from the hotel, because the beaches are private, and to cross, you need permission to sleep on them, you need permission. Mm. And just before I got kicked out, I got a job painting the changing room on the changing cottages on the beach.
Wow.
I got a job to paint them because the new season on the outside.
Amazing.
Yeah, blue, green, you know. And I was getting paid 4,000 lira, which was like, I don't know, back then maybe it was like a ten an hour a day. And then I got kicked out because I got kicked out of Venice because I made a performance, you know.
What was that?
Well, I didn't know I was making a performance, but I made a performance of myself. Basically, 9 o'clock, every Sunday.
Yes.
At 9 o'clock in the morning, there's like a group of marine musicians. The marine will come and raise the tree flag in San Marco at 9 o'clock.
Oh,
that used to
it.
Be. Yeah. I don't know if they still do it, but 9 o'clock in the morning, they will raise the flag for the tourists. There will be like about 20, 30 American tourists mainly back then. Yeah. And taking photos and clapping after they're done. And there will be the two Venetian flags with the middle of the Italian flag. Yeah, I remember. Mm-hmm. And I saw the spectacle, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning. And after they clapped, I was about 20 yards away from them. I start jumping and clapping at them, taking the piece out of them. So I attracted attention. And I got about 4 or 6 different. This was the moment where I would get stopped every day by the police to ask for a day what I was doing in Venice. So suddenly I made
Were you tattooed at the time?
No, I wasn't tattooed.
So you look perfectly ordinary.
Yes, but they knew. Yeah, but I didn't look no ordinary. I never was. I had rotten teeth.
So what did she look like?
I looked like. I only had a pair of trousers I was wearing.
Yeah.
I never washed my teeth. And probably
Did you have a t-shirt on?
I probably had a t-shirt and a sleeping bag I had, I remember. Brown sleeping bag. Mm. I don't remember if it was brown because I was carrying it around for a while. Mm. And I don't know if you know Nishit. I don't know if you know Nishit Sharat is doing a show.
Yeah, yeah, I just seen it.
Yeah,
yes,
you
yes,
saw it.
Yes,
okay.
Yes,
that wasn't gated before.
Yes.
Was not gated. We used to sleep just up the stairs in the cave, in the cover, where in the flat bit before you get in the library. And there will be about 15, 20 people every night sleeping there, especially in the winter, because it's also safe in groups, and the police didn't come there. Yeah.
Yeah, so what's interesting retrospectively is that people could look in that little cabinet now when they go downstairs.
Yeah.
And the fact is you're not just objectifying things and making something that is, I mean, you can't really see from these miniatures, making these works of art that are really performative objects that you placed in places which were very disconcerting.
Yeah.
But it actually related to a lived experience, and it was a different place from Italy.
When they invited me, when this important festival, which had like Yoko Ono doing something the same year, and some other people, called Open in 2003, which runs Iran's collateral with the Biennale, when they asked me to do a performance, I said no. I said I want to bring the sleeping people. It was the first time back in Venice since I've been kicked out.
Interesting.
So I said I want to come back, and I told them they were really interested in my kind of autobiography and the Venice relationship. Because when they approached me, I said, oh, Venice, I was kicked out of Venice, blah, 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 and I told them the story. And I said, why don't I do, it was 2003 and I just finished the book was ready. I said, why don't I print some of this and put them in place where I used to sleep or where I couldn't sleep, So under the Lido, and he said, well, you want to do it? I can arrange this, you know, and I said, I wanted to do it in the most expensive, exclusive place. And there's two or three on the Lido, and this Bayern, I think this hotel is called Bay.
Oh, the Bauer Hotel in the middle of, not on the Lido,
And they said yes.
Yeah,
so
okay.
I could where use the park. And I put about 15, 20 pieces that
That's
I printed in London, and I sent over. And they were life size with like the back, you know, and I put them all around, and I remember.
And it really does double take, especially like in the dark when you're walking home, as people do in Venice.
And the locals would pass it, but couldn't go in, because there was a gate. And one day, I was there for a few days, and I remember hearing some local saying, oh, look at these, you know, these fucking people, what they're doing here now, you know, these homeless people. And then they realized what it is, and they said, what is this rubbish doing here? Why? You know, and I was looking at them.
But it's interesting, it doesn't have any names or anything, because you do double take, because of the perspective in the folds of things. Yeah, because I didn't, it's amazing, we both just come back from Venice, but I didn't really know this Venice story, because I was very moved seeing those in their installations in London.
I mean, seeing and there was a moment where I was having this kind of this kind, especially on a Saturday and on a Sunday, before they done the big change in the city, this is 2002, 2003, I was taking this, because my studio is not very far, Toynbee Studio, in Commercial Street, before it was taken over by the city, so I could carry this kind of cutout, and I would put them aside the Northwest building, which at the moment was one of the biggest buildings in London, and around there, and of course I would count kind of issues about private property, you know, like this, you know, the security guy will come out, usually the security guy will come out and say, you can't leave it there, or you cannot take photos, because this is, so I would argue with them about, you know, why is it private? Is it, no, it's owned by, you know, and of course, you know that. Even the South Bank is private, you know.
Because you told me as well that you did have a period when you slept rough on top of, not like on top of the Hayward Gallery, but on some kind of space in the South Bank.
Yeah, in the South Bank, not the, the South Bank. The South Bank, before it was glamorized and before they gated it, because eventually they gated it, people used to sleep Cardboard City on top during the first phase of Ken Livingstone. That people, there was full of people shooting before the skateboard park upstairs, and now they painted, they gated it about 20 years ago after the wheel went up. They did a big clear.
Oh, because they didn't want people from the wheel to look down onto the...
No,
anyway, but you slept there as well, didn't you?
Yes, I slept there at the beginning, at the very beginning. I was all over. Mainly Hyde Park Corner, Buckingham Palace around the area, because they open. They open spaces. They don't close, they can't close them at night. You know? So, you slept, and toilet, public toilet when they used to be open. And then eventually I moved to Brixton, where I met people, and I lived in squats, really, when squats was very
easy.
That
was a much more comfortable part of your existence.
Yes or no?
Yeah. Well, I mean, anyway, the thing is that what I think is interesting is you actually did live the experience that you were depicting downstairs.
Yes.
And also existential.
But also what I wanted to do, I want to show the fact is this kind of, also is kind of connected with the time Giuliani came to power the first time in New York and the cleansing. And I was in New York just before the tower came down. And I really felt there was a real kind of fascistic, not, you know, all the homeless people were pushed beyond 14th Street down towards the kind of, the kind of Brooklyn side, or this side, but where it was kind of no-go areas, you know. And so when I went back to London, I wanted to bring this kind of, the fact that you, you know, you couldn't camp in the city. You couldn't camp on the stairs of St. Paul. You know, you couldn't. You get kicked out straight away. This place is, you know, in the city the same. So I will leave the cat out and come and move away 50 yards and take photo and wait it, like on a Saturday afternoon or Sunday, you know, when there wasn't so much traffic in terms of people, but it was more kind of every so often. And then sometimes the security will see it, will come out and move it, kind of pick it up, and I would come and rescue it. I would say, it's mine. And he say, you can't leave it here. So I would take it. And sometimes I would play a game. He would go in, and then I would put it just a little bit where he couldn't see it. And then, of course, he could see the cameras, or he would know that I was playing, you know. And I took a lot of, I did some amazing photos, work. And I like the fact that this kind of, you know, that there have been traveler or homeless and being kind of mobile, also as a cutout, you cannot move your, you can move.
You can move
in a way without, without knowing, I was doing street art before Banksy. You know?
So listen, what I want to do
without knowing,
if we think of moving from
so
this experience, of, which is so interesting, of being inside, being outside, and also being, even in 2003, being inside the institution of art and being outside at the same time, outside and inside, which is one of the things.
Well, it's interesting. 2003 is where I perform and take more than. And at the same time, I was making work. I was, you know, marginal.
Saying the your position versus what you call downstairs as the greatest tragedy since the Second World War, and the inability of Europe to manage this recent crisis is very, very huge. And so I want to now move from that lived experience in which you're empathizing with urban communities being displaced, policemen kicking people, clearing things up, making this kind of manicured city which is fit for tourists and bankers. Yeah. I want to move from that now to the Sleeping Beauty piece, because obviously it's about a much, much bigger problem.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of sculpture. It's in a different kind of media. Yeah. Shall we go back and talk first of all about how that photograph, which affected so many people that particular year, it affected everybody. And I was asked to speak at a biennale in the Urals, and I can't remember what, it was something to do with political art and so forth, but I felt compelled to end my talk with that image too. So I'm just saying it not only circulated in the media, but many people felt compelled to talk about it. Yeah. And in Venice at the moment, there's a church with a Serbian artist who's done a series with that picture. So can you first of all, perhaps, and of course the picture
it's
was initially,
picture.
But initially the one that was circulated everywhere was anonymous.
That was the dog boy. It's not the same.
This happened just before or just after.
And at first this image was not famous. It's only, I found it by chance in Italy. I remember it was in my school where I was teaching, and I was looking at the computer in the school and I found it. And when I came back to London, I could not find it. I went back to Italy to teach 3 weeks after, and I got it from the memory of the computer of the school, and then I sent the link to myself. And it was from a Palestinian speaking language blog about what was going on in Syria. Yeah. And I couldn't, there was no translation, and I find this image. Then later on, when I went to refine it, I found a series father image, but I didn't know the photographer name. There was no photographer name at the time. Yeah. And I only discovered the photographer via a political research, Philip.
So this is Khaled Barakay.
Yes, which I actually wrote to him, but he hasn't answered me. Yeah. But he has accepted me as a friend on his Facebook, but he has not commented. Yeah, I wrote him a long kind of email messages, kind of explain, you know, that he came to, you know. But he accepted read my message, and he accepted my request to be his friend on Facebook, but did not respond to any of the kind of correspondence I had.
So first of all, this image really shocked and affected you, and then
I saw it, and then I don't know how it came about. There was other images, but this was, I thought what this image had, it was like, it could be about a lot of other things. It wasn't just about drowning, but it was about death, it was about also kind of rape, you know, this kind of rape of life, this kind of, you know. And but mainly I think it was to do with, I felt it was this kind of impotence, you know, this kind of, the people we didn't vote for are responsible for this, or voted for, are responsible for this, for not intervening, or for still kind of somehow keeping this kind of status quo, you know, allowing, I decided that this image at the moment was not the poster boy of refugee drowning. The other boy was. And although I used the other boy in teaching when soon it first happened, and I encountered criticism on Facebook for using dead kids, and people said, you know, that made me want to make a piece of work about, you know, why can't we talk about that? You know, what can we talking about? You know, that is our node. Mm. You know, images. So, if you took out of the context this image, it could be violence every day. Mm. It could be any type of violence. It's not just the violence of being displaced, but the violence that politics and status quos and not doing nothing. You know,
but you decided to do something rather extraordinary, which was to invest, as I understand it, a lot of your own money to make this.
Yes, because I didn't want to go to a gallery, apart I don't really work with gallery, but also it was a lot of money. I remember when I first said, I had a young assistant in Italy that made some metal sculpture for me, and I said to him, this was in Mark, I said, do you know anyone that can work stone, you know, a very good stone carver? And he said, you're crazy, it's going to cost a lot of money. And then I was talking to a curator that also teaches art history where I used to teach. Mm. And he said, you know what, I know somebody that can help you. And this woman is a 60 years old model maker.
So this is a woman who's 60 years old who's done this
one. Who done the first face. Yeah. He was responsible for the Cicciolina and Jeff Koons boost.
Oh, I think
she made it.
Said this to me, yes.
She made it.
Yes, wow.
So I sent the image and she asked me why. She replies, ask why.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, it's political, it's personal, it's poetic. It can be. And she said, I want to do it. You know, but it's going to cost you 30,000. And I said, okay. Well, it's about, you know, more or less it was 25 and then it went up. Euro. Yeah. The euro was still, when the pound was still, would have been 35,000. Would have been 33,000.
So why did you want to do it in marble?
Well, because two things. Because marble is high art, and also there was an interesting thing that go back. The first thing, for some reason, when she asked me about the style, I remember having you talking about on the Sabank show interview about Bernini, the Cilicious, San Sebastian, you know, Omerotti, it was you talking about. And I would say, I want to do this kind of sculpture. I wanted somehow trick. You know, because in fact it was happened when I first published this image, you know, a lot of people came back, you know, I really respect your work, but you crossed the line, this is pedophilia, and you definitely, you know, come into my trap, you know, because actually it turned around, it's actually it's not. But you, because I knew the first thing also being me, and people knowing I'm homosexual, thinking that there was this kind of erotic thing. But it was. I didn't have to do anything. You know, it's people's imagination. The moment that you cannot take it out of the context and make it into an object, a beautiful object, and really well craft, it becomes.
So we can talk about that, because actually what you've done is bring up the issue, which I was going to bring up, as it were, slightly later, because funnily enough,
I say something?
Yeah, yeah.
Because what's happened? The sculpture wasn't supposed to be like this. Because my original idea was going to be that the photo, you only see you don't see the face. You see the other side. Mm. You see the other side. And the face is kind of in water and out of focus. You don't see it. Mm. And so when I spoke to her, I said I wanted to be like it was suddenly turned into stone. Like it looked back. And there's, of course, this kind of mythology, you know, people running away from Aura, like this kid is running around from Aura, and he looks back and he drowns, he kind of becomes stones, you know, and in a way I wanted that, when you saw it, you see this beautiful finished piece of work, and when you turn around, you just saw it broke, it didn't finish, but she didn't do that. When I went to see the first model in clay, she said, you might not like it, but I decided to do it this way. If you don't like it, I cut it, I break it. So when I saw, she did the real model, she invented the face. Mm. The face is not his face. You know, it's very different from the photo. And so what's happened, I said, I like it. Mm. Let's keep it like that. So in a way, she kind of somehow license, somehow contributed to the work. And I was happy to say, it's fine, I really like it, why not? And actually then I could kind of somehow work on a different type of kind of fantasy, the fact that, yeah, and there was a lot of issues, there was a lot of things when I spoke to the, so she didn't sculpt it, although she worked on Damien Hirst's latest work, some of the big round, granite things on the back of one of the first room, the big camo symbol, she worked on that for over a year. Yeah.
I see. Yeah. So I just want to go back to the Bernini issue, because firstly I'd forgotten about it, but secondly, when I read the panel downstairs, I thought, Bernini? This is much more Canova. Someone's got it wrong here. So no. I just wanted to say something to you.
Maybe, in style, but my fantasy was Bernini.
Yeah, this is interesting, because my perception was that in terms of its coldness and its whiteness, and the fact that it has a young lying figure, that there's a certain kind of sexuality involved, and as we know, Canova did the hermaphrodite.
No,
well.
But tell you another thing. Did you see both San Sebastian by Bernini? The earlier one is the one standing up, and the latest one, 50 years later, he made the one where he's in a glass deck, and he's lying down.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
But anyway, basically it's neoclassical, you've made something that was warm and living and then dead, very cold and white.
Yes.
And also for this poor child, it is its equivalent tombstone.
Yes, but I tell you the difference.
Yeah.
Because I had the option for a few thousand euro more to polish it.
To make it shiny, I suppose.
And I said no, because it reminds me of tombs, it reminds me of church. Tombs of king,
you
princes.
Think if it was polished, it would be even more.
It would ruin
more.
It. Yeah, yes. It would have ruined it. Yeah, it becomes something, not ruined it, but it becomes something else. And I chose not to polish it. And it wasn't for money. Cause it become like a sort of things you find in a church, and I didn't want that.
But on the other hand, of course, there's a tradition of children in that kind of sculpture, like cherubs.
Usually it's polished.
All sorts of things. Yeah. Polished or not polished. I mean, all I'm saying is it's not unusual to see young, naked male children in art. So there is this kind of way to thinking about Aufhebung today, freezing a Freudian term, the kind of past is being dragged into the present in a rather uncanny way, to use another Freudian term. You wrote about the uncanny. There's a very strange way. There's something very strange about it being turned into marble without any consideration of the homoeroticism.
But the original, it was the idea that when people run away from things, from this mythology, from the Bible, is that they turn into stone because of the horror saw. And in a way, it was kind of, that was the connection of the man. But also, I wanted to have this kind of neoclassic, I wanted to look like it could have been done 300 years ago. Yeah.
Yes, which of course puts the situation of the refugee into a much, much longer time frame. Yeah.
But for me, the most emotional piece.
Yes.
When I saw the sculpture finished, when I went to see it, what made me cry was the shoes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there, went like there's some little kind of punctum there, the thing that makes it actual.
Yeah, and it was weird that when I looked at the detail of the shoes, which he invented, the guy invented them, because you can see from the photo.
So a woman invented the face and things, and then a guy...
But then the sculptor guy, but it was under direction, and I was getting photographs. But so what happened, they did from the photo... They did the model, and then the model in clay became a plaster model, and then they copied them in the old school, where they put nails, screw, and they kind of have dissolved piece, and they measure, there's three stages. There's a guy had to buy two ton of marble to get 230 kilo out.
Incredible.
Yes, because that time wasn't enough to buy 2 tons of marble, and then there's a guy that kind of makes the shapes, then there is the anatomy, the guy that does the anatomy, does it, and then there is the master guy that basically the anatomist, the guy in the middle, because they're all guys and they're all like in the 60, 70, retired. Because the young people can't do the work anymore.
Yeah.
They don't want to do it. It's too dirty.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's too
dirty.
Yes, I mean, they find it very difficult to find young people to work in this kind of manual.
But this means that you become a master, Frank. So what is it like for you to suddenly, having been the equivalent of one of the objects, the homeless objects that you depict? What is it? I mean, I'm interested in your idea of authorship, because I think that if I were you, which obviously I'm not, I would have wanted to write.
I'm not worried about authorship.
I know you're not, but I would have wanted to put that woman's name somewhere. So, I mean, so funnily enough, you're having been in this really low position, you're the equivalent of Michelangelo saying, okay, Mr. Anatomy.
Yeah, but I'm not Michelangelo.
Okay, no, but I'm just saying.
But it's different.
The position is strange and interesting.
Yeah, but it's like, you know.
And did you hang around with all these 60 and 70 year old guys?
No, I hung around with her a few times because I had to see her and we became friends.
Yeah.
And she was very busy at the same time working with Damien Hirst. And
for somebody of that age, it must be rather fantastic doing this.
Yeah, she's a
project.
Yeah, but she's kind of, she's interesting. She has a lot of story and she works with, I mean, she told me the story when she was working with Cicciolina and, I was like hilarious. And Jeff Koon when they came to this small town. Which coincidentally is very near where I went with the Red Cross.
Yeah.
Very near where I went to the colony with the Red Cross in the summer. Yeah, Marina.
So listen, and I want people here who've been listening attentively to our dialogue.
And not get bored.
I don't think they could be listening to you, Franco, but I want them to be able to ask you questions. So I just want to ask you one really last important thing. And that is, this is a very sacred space in all sorts of different ways. It's sacred to Freud, and it recounts the story of Freud as a refugee with no money, the destruction of the threat to his whole life work under Nazism, the way he was saved, but also it's like the citadel of psychoanalysis, and it's a place that's really rich, not only with stories, with small stories, with big stories, but your sculpture now, which is so very permanent because of its materials, and it containing its own story, permanent and fragile, it's in a very special place. I want to ask you, just to end with, before we ask people to contribute, what that means to you in terms of being here, and how you also, this is a completely different question, because here is so important, thanks to all the people who've helped to put it here, but also how you see the future of your sculpture and where you think it should go, how you see its life in the future. So it's two things. One thing is to do with...
One was very interesting, Anna Freud work on trauma and childhood, so it fitted.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much because of, you know, of the father. I was very, very interested in the connection was to do with Anna.
Children.
I wasn't so interested. Mm. I mean, that was the connection. That was the contest in which it was kind of the invitation was, and it made sense to me. Mm. Yeah? It made sense also the kind of the narrative never stopped.
Yeah.
You know, the trauma goes on. Mm. You know, and also I'm interested in the traumas of wars, and you can, you know, it's a big battlefield.
Of course, yes.
It's not just wars in terms of kind of, you know, running away, but the wars to do with domestic violence, domestic trauma, you know, poverty traumas.
Which you talk about a lot in your autobiography.
Yes, of course. And so to me, just kind of, it was kind of fitted. It's a detail. It's it's not a big detail, but when I was asked or told about this opportunity and contest, I thought it makes sense because in a way, not in a psychoanalytic way, but in a way I'm kind of talking about, you know, the kind of 50 years later, we are talking about
the same,
you know, the same thing, the traumas, the memory, you know, because the trauma is also, I think, it's on the memory, on our memory. Mm. I'm traumatized by these images. Mm. And that's why I'm also compared to you. I feel compelled and I have a responsibility to kind of somehow allow them to live in outside this kind of pornographic wallpaper that the internet can become a bank, you know, for this kind of whatever you want, whatever they buy, you know, or guns, you know, blogs, you have kind of, you know, this kind of refugee, you know, which is in a way sometimes treated the same. Mm. It just becomes some kind of masturbation material, whatever, even if it's not physical, but certainly in terms of having something to talk about or that turns you on or off. So I wanted to make justice, not just to this kid, but to the memory. You know, hopefully in 50 years, 100 years, if the scope is still around, and of course things will not really change, there will be still traumas going on.
Yeah.
But these kids will be forgotten. This image will be forgotten. But the sculpture will somehow talk about that, the narrative of why it's, what is this? You know, in the same, in a way, we talk about, you know, Bellini, you know, work, you know?
Well, it's interesting that the sculpture is here at this moment in this particular place.
Where is it going to go?
Also in displacement.
It's going to go where people want it, where it makes sense to be.
Exactly.
I mean, now the sculpture now is going to leave it's going to leave at the political, which is a foundation, which they own it. They bought it. You know.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, can I say it? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So in a way. My job is done. I'm working already on that.
But it's looked after.
So
and it will be able to travel and able to say what it has to say in all sorts of different places.
Yes.
And this is the first time that it's speaking to a certain public in London, I think.
Totally. It's been shown in Italy.
Yeah, you showed me an installation shot in your film,
which was very different.
Yes,
but yes, it was shown in Italy, and then it came to London, and it was in a public event that political organized. So some people saw it. It was a specific event about, you know, we call it
culture.
Yes, and so we defeated, and now it comes here, and then. The world is oyster, I suppose.
Yes.
In a way, this culture is going to travel.
Yes, and I think it's interesting to think of its past and to think of its future.
Yes.
And I think maybe at this point we'll ask people if they have any questions for Franco, I think he said an amazingly rich amount about its past, its present, and now we've talked about its future, but I'm sure people would like to participate. And please feel free to participate in our discussion because I think we've said our little bit and we need to have some input from all of you.
Yeah, if you want to.
Yeah.
If you just want to drink, we go.
And you can also bring up some of these other issues that Franco has touched on slightly, including... I mean, I've seen you've moved now from the Academy in Maserati to the Academy in Turin.
Torino.
Yes, very, very smart. I mean, a place with a long tradition.
Yes.
I'm quite interested in academies and their very strange relationship to the contemporary all the time.
Yeah.
So come on, everybody. I'm sure somebody's got something to ask. I mean, this is not one of the pass the mic things. We haven't even got a mic. Let's just animate this with some other voices.
Yeah. It's okay. Yes.
So there's been a lot of discussions in the art world recently about who owns trauma specifically from certain groups.
Yeah.
And in ways I think that's relevant and not relevant to this particular piece of work I'm speaking about, Sleeping Beauty. But perhaps in this case, your personal ownership of the trauma of this child and the death of this child and this corpse that you found in marble, Is your ownership of it not an ownership of the culpability?
No.
A collective culpability for it?
Also, I'm culpable somehow, you know, because in a way, is the nobility somehow, you know, I'm 57 and nothing has changed really. You know, we were, you know, remember fuck the system, no war, doing anti-nuclear things in my 20s, you know, and nothing has changed, you know. Nothing has changed. You know, I remember going to Anti-Falkland. And, I mean, you know, I think it's a, there is a kind of optimism when you're young that you can change things. But it's not the reason why you shouldn't. Although, you know, it's very easy to become nihilistic and cynical, it's important somehow to stay optimistic. You know, it's important to somehow have a belief system that, you know, allows, that kind of makes you think it's not acceptable. You cannot accept the unacceptable. You can't maybe change, do so much about it, but certainly you can make work and you can somehow have a, you know, a narrative which is about make sure that you're not just, I'm not just a passive witness, but something, somehow, not recycling, but kind of, the trauma, my personal trauma, with coming across images which I cannot switch off. I can go to bed and close my eyes and don't think. Somehow I feel this is my call to do something more poetic and somehow something that is not so, is, and then you move to the next one. I think it's good somehow for me to kind of freeze, to froze it, you know, to froze it and kind of present it. So it doesn't just become one of the millions, you know, one of the millions images or kind of things that kind of makes you blink, you know. But somehow you can acknowledge it and somehow pay homage to it, you know? And I think that is very important. I was doing an interview 3 or 4 months ago to somebody that is doing she's a psychiatric and working with refugees and working a trio. She's kind of working way, and she came and interviewed me. And I said, the thing is, also, of course, is that somehow there is this, you know, material, there's this pornography that is given to us based on the suffering of others, you know. You have to be very careful. It's too easy. You know, there is an industry of making work about the others. The other suffering, you know, it's like, you know, it's like think, ooh, you don't think, but it's like sometimes some people like Weiwei needs this kind of material. You know, what would happen? You know, if he, you know, his market, you know, if he just made nice object of it, you know, it has to, you know, where I don't have the problem. Because I always been quite arty-farty. I love art, you know. I love the language of art and the poetry. You know, it's not just I can make a piece of work about a dildo, you know. I mean, you know, about, you know, whatever. You know, about something that turns me on, you know. So it doesn't have to, you know, it's not like I'm gonna make something political, so it's gonna get noticed. You know, I don't need to. I use my body, you know. So in a way, I don't need to go there. Now I'm in a luxury, in a way, I think I'm in a luxury position not to have to somehow follow a particular style or signature, you know, and make the work I want to make. And that's the most important thing. This is how, in a way, I measure success. I always say to my student, I say, how do you measure success? I mean, on paper, I'm not that successful, but I'm successful to me because I make the work I want to fucking make, whatever that means, you know? If I have to take my pants down or, maybe now, you know, I'm too old to take my pants down. You know, so I need to think of other strategies. But essentially, you know,
I think the comparison with Jeff Koons and Kitsch is very interesting, because there's this huge industry, and in one funny way, your idea of freezing the moment, and the fact that despite all the costs we've been talking about, you have like a micro industry for one unique work, is really very
significant.
No, but I mean it's very anti-Koons, because however complex, provocative, or even disturbing the piece is, it is a unique piece which crystallizes the complete debate we've had this evening in some very strong way, especially this idea of the kind of Medusa image you've been talking about the freezing and the terror.
Yeah.
I think it's very interesting, actually, including all the problems, all the contemporary stuff, all the internet stuff we've been talking about. It would be lovely to have another question, if it's possible. Let's say we'll just have two, all right? So we want more than one.
Because we're sort of Freud Museum. Because the image of a child that's dead, well, as soon as I see the image of a child that's dead, you think, well, you maybe think of the sort of Staglieno cemetery, or the time when children, when it was very common that children died. And what I really want to ask you about is whether I go about the monk, because whenever you see a child, there's also a monk.
It's true. The mother wasn't there.
And one of the things that, also when you talk about coming here, and you mentioned military service, one of the things that has never been done, to my astonishment, nobody, no man that I can think of in this country where we owe a massive amount of, we're hugely indebted to the women who worked in all positions in the Second World War, and also in Russia, that the women took on roles during the Second World War that was never taken on in previous conflicts. As a result of that, we had the welfare state. And in Russia, they had certain things which were benefited. One of the things that was a benefit to men is that they weren't having to go into national service in this country. And not one man that I know of has ever thought how this has perhaps affected, you know, maybe it's something, one of the things I keep thinking is we're really losing, that from the 79, from the 80s, there was only 30 years after the war when everybody, including women, were able to be trained right to the highest level, to PhD level, and that we had a free health service, and we had pensions. This was as a result of the mother in society. So when I come here and I see the sculpture there, and I think of the mother, and I think about, you know, of course you think about the religious sculptures and so on, but the idea that you look after, that this idea of looking after, when I think of you, very particularly, you, not just because of homosexuality or anything like that, but there is, you actually, to some extent, have a very, very strong maternal stroke paternal, like the two sides of the animus and anima, which is a bit going over into the Jung, is kind of somehow happening. It's, you know, it's happened because we're actually a very privileged group of people in one sense, because most of the men in this room don't have to go to the military service to start. So that means they weren't going to be conditioned as, you know, with the mass neuroses that is repeating itself throughout history. So we have this microcosm of experience in this country in particular, because of this thing of education and looking after everybody, so that everybody has a possibility, at least. Only 30 years has changed.
Yeah, it's definitely changed because of Thatcher and neoliberalism. But also I think there was other wars, and not just this war, because I think possibly, I speak personally, without the AIDS crisis, although it's not connected, I would not be able to make this kind of work. Because I think there is a pathology, I think, of kind of consequences and kind of, you know, absorbing, you know, lost. This idea, I think, I mean, I can only speak for me, because I'm a kind of age where I remember, you know, seeing images similar about people dying because of AIDS. So it's certainly, I mean, it changes the fact.
You mean it sensitized you to death as a young
Yes,
man.
Certainly, yes, and especially, yeah, definitely, totally. I mean, I was 23 and I mean, I was kind of one age and one moment that so I'm not gonna make it to 25 and then AIDS comes and you think shit. You know, most people didn't make it. And then also, you know, also as you think you have something else in your hand, you know. And so it was thought that suddenly you think, you know, stop making a, you kind of realize that it stopped maybe mucking about and thinking and make the decision, whatever. You know, it's not certainly, suddenly it's like a death of innocence, for sure. Mm. You know, some people are much younger.
And yet the appeal of Sleeping Beauty is its innocence. What about the title? Which Sleeping Beauty implies that Sleeping Beauty is going to wake up in some way.
Yeah, but so, it can. I keep alive. Mm. I keep alive by turning into a scot by... Mm. You know, in a way, this kind of poison, kind of, you know, this kind of, yes, in this case, we are, I mean, interesting, you know, this kind of, not the fake mother, but what is it called, you know, this kind of Sleeping Beauty, and then the prince is not going to turn up, the fairy tale, you know, it's not fairy tale, you know, the prince is not going to turn up. But I somehow wanted to have this kind of, you know, kind of double, and also kind of disgraceful kind of title, you know, wanted to be kind of poetic. It's a beauty, you know, because in a way some, you know, there is certainly an element of violence or what you call, proposed, you know, like with the trousers down and that kind of stuff. But it's, yeah, so it's kind of plain.
I think this idea that Franco is looking after it and that it is in some way that you have some kind of relation to it that's an emotive relationship.
Also, well, they want the image to just be forgotten because somehow I felt I had to make a monument. You know, it's in the same way. Mm. Derek Jarman made a monument with Requiem, I think, when he made Requiem, you know, the film about the war, you know, in the trenches, you know. It wasn't my favorite film, but I remember the film very important when I saw it at the ICA when it came out, you know. It was the first time I somehow could think about, you know, the First World War and kind of thinking, and yeah, I mean... Do you ever seen this film? Requiem by...
No, I haven't.
It's very still. It's a beautiful... I mean, it's funny because I never saw it as my favorite film, but it's a film that somehow, like, blue, really kind of, you know, kind of stayed, you know, and I'm not a big fan. I like the German, but I'm not a big fan. I was a big fan of the Super Short, Super 8 films. Or the more kind of, you know, kind of.
He liked the war equipment.
But that's an amazing.
Because of the music of Benjamin Britten.
Mm. Possibly. No, I remember the monument. You know, it's like the statues with this body and this woman actually.
Musical Britten.
Yes, it was very. But I remember it was kind of sepia, black and white. And I don't know if I saw it with you, but I saw it at the ICA. When it 80. Mid-80s.
So that was interesting because it had the idea of the monument.
Before Blue. Well before Blue.
So shall we just have one last question? and then perhaps we'll continue more informally.
Yes.
I did ask Carol actually about timing, rather stupidly, before we began this. But is there one last question for Franco? I'm sure there must be just one. Or for, obviously for me, but I don't think it's the point. I think the point is to ask you, Franco, while you're here, especially as you suddenly bring extremely interesting things suddenly up. I mean, even watching the way your memory works in this particular environment, in relationship to what we've seen, I think is very interesting. So one last question for Franco, please, somebody. Go on. Yes, go on.
Kind of a personal question. I want to ask about the existential crisis that you went through. Because funnily enough, when I was 13, I started going through an existential crisis as well. And then for me, I just thought, okay, if I'm going to live, then I might as well do something meaningful in my life. And I thought I would use art to create social or political artworks to make something. But at times it gets so exhausting, and I just kind of want to ask, like, what do you live for now? Is art just a coping mechanism, or is it something greater that's worth living for?
No, I'm not interested in coping. The key thing, I think, is to, I think, this moment where you cannot ask you, by everybody, I think, there's nothing special, I think, about, there's no distinct the individual, I think. Everybody has the canon, cannot question and cannot, why we are, you know, why I'm suffering, why I bother, you know, it doesn't matter, it's gonna end anyway, and you're not gonna remember it, you know, and you must as well, sometimes go out while you can go out, and rather than kind of kept alive and you don't have any choice. But this moment that you get the joy de vivre, you know, this kind of in somebody else maybe as well, when you meet somebody, I get it with my student, you know, I get a lot of life out of my students, you know. In a way, it's interesting to me. I'm not interested in I would say to them, you know, in a way, what I'm doing, I'm facilitate some kind of discourse. But being there, they facilitate some kind of discourse. Without them, I would not be, I'd be talking to myself, really, you know. So the interesting thing about the teaching, although I don't believe in the idea that you can teach something, but especially art, you know, is about sharing and kind of sharing and then personal, you know, kind of you get this kind of empathies or sometimes even having this kind of, you know, what you call a not only connection, but also resistance to what you do. You know, because also I get resistance from some of my students. That resistance is also, in a way for me to kind of question and kind of, or defend what I believe, you know. It's a kind of, you know, entry of, you know, this kind of reason to live, you know, to be able. So, what I think is important, you know, I think the moment that being alone becomes loneliness, then you're dead, or you want to die. The moment that I'm alone, but I'm not lonely, you know, then I still want to kind of live, you know. It's just like what gets you out of bed, you know. And maybe it's also in a way, maybe not physically, you know, this moment where I get erection, but they're not connected with my penis. They get erection inside my brain. I get the moment kind of where I feel like when I was 19 and I was a punk and say, yes, fuck it. You know, and you don't do it in the same way. Maybe not in the same kind of drinking tequila and shooting speed, but you do it maybe by just having a glass of wine and kind of, you know, or kind of going to see a show or being with people that kind of want to be with you, you know. Life is really, you know, I'm not a philosopher, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a social worker, you know. In a way, I'm like everybody else, I try to kind of find a dignified way of staying alive, you know. Really staying alive, and there's a difference between staying alive and just kind of, you know, just kind of doing this, you know, just kind of managing. I'm not interested in managing, you know. I'm not interested in just kind of keeping things cool, because that would be my death, you know. Not maybe physical one. But, so the key thing is, why am I stuck there? Why do I want to get up tomorrow morning? Why do I have to get up tomorrow morning? You know, because I have to pay rent, because I have to go to my studio. No, I don't have to if I don't want to, you know. If I don't have a reason to die, I don't have to, you know. I'm quite happy with what, in a way, I'm happy. I'm happy with what I achieved. It's not that I have a dream or vision to become, you know, something else than what I am or something bigger. I'm not interested, you know. I think the key things, yes, this is existential and kind of practical things, you know, I have to fucking pay my rent, I have to find a way of making work, you know, but at the same time, if there wasn't the joy to be, I wouldn't have to, you know, why, you know.
But I think what's so wonderful is that your question was a rather wonderful way of opening things up, and all the time you've been speaking, Franco, we have Freud here in his engraving.
Yeah.
Looking rather studiously at his rather erect sculptures.
I have an issue and with him because he always blames the mother. I don't blame the mother. Although I have an issue with my mother.
Nonetheless, he was asking himself the same questions. And I think that he would have been...
It was like, you know, it's a bit misogynistic.
You can imagine him being very astonished.
Mother for everything.
He would have been very astonished.
And although, you know, I have a reason to blame my mother, but I don't blame my mother. Yeah.
That's great. We know very little about Freud.
Yeah.
So I think that there is something going on here. I think a lot has been going on. Thank you again to everyone for facilitating the works downstairs and Franco coming into this place.
Thank you very much.
Freud Museum. And then we can continue. And this is a never-ending conversation, Franco, obviously.
Yeah.
A never-ending conversation.
Well, it will end
thank
eventually.
You all. Well, yes, when we're all dead, yes. But thank you all very, very much indeed. And we will continue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.